Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Welcome and hello. Well, we're right on time tonight. Thanks, Claire. That's my granddaughter, Claire. She was the only one in the audience. And she's awesome, kid. I'm telling you. She's such a sweetheart. Okay, honey, thank you for coming down. And now you can leave. See ya. Papa loves you. Isn't she great? Makes a lot of noise for a 9-year-old, doesn't she? This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I don't know if any of you heard about that. The science has discovered an unknown universe. There's another separate and totally distinct universe. They didn't know that existed. I was so excited when I heard the prospect. The first thing I did was I went out and applied for the position of center. And the crickets chirp. Center of the universe, that's me. I might not be much, but I'm all I think about. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and sweet home Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. And they do this at no cost, no fee. Well, there's always a cost, but there was no fee, and they do this because they believe in what we're doing. We believe in what we're doing, and we want you to believe in what we're doing. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. And as a matter of fact, we have an article going in, finally, in their April edition. It should be a real kicker. We've been trying to get this thing in there for about 3 or 4 months now, but finally we went all through the necessary steps, and they're going to post it, and it goes out to about 36,000 folks. So hopefully we'll get a bounce on Rum Radio from that. We pray. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation, so does the country, so does the world. We have found that most of the problems we have with alcohol and drugs stem from a breakdown of the family. Latchkey kids growing up as empty lot weeds, nobody's there. If you teach a child correct principles, they can teach themselves. But without those correct principles, it's a crapshoot, folks. They go to the gangs and the clubs, and they peer pressure, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, except it's at a younger and younger age. So we're getting kids coming into the program now, 13, 14 years old, tattooed, holes in their bodies, addicted to you name it, and they got it. It's usually not so much with the alcohol we find, is because I like to think of alcohol as a slow blow, pardon the pun. It's usually the drugs are bringing them in, but usually alcohol is always the most convenient drug of choice. 5 times as many people die from alcohol than all the other drugs combined. So alcohol is always the most available drug. It is a drug. I don't care what people say or they don't say. It's an addictive process. you got to remember, it was an illegal substance in 1919 to 1931, the Volstead Act. Now it's legal. Now they got marijuana is legal. Wow. So, you know, who knows? Some places heroin is legal. Does that make it right? No, it just means it makes it legal, and they try to, the rationale is the government makes money, and it cuts out the criminal element because some people are just going to do drugs, whether you make it legal or illegal. So that's always that, the moral issue always goes out there. I don't think it's a good idea. I think when the government needs to stand firm on these things, but, you know, money's money, folks. It is a capitalist society, and money talks. So here at Rum Radio, I like to think of us like starfish throwers. A red tide comes in, and there's millions of starfish that are washed up on the shore. And if they don't get back in the water, they're going to die. And a fellow goes out there, and he's flinging starfish. And another guy comes along and he says, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm throwing starfish back into the water so they could live. He says, there's millions of these things out here. You'll never get all of them. He says, yeah, I know I won't get all of them, but I'll get the ones we can get. And that's what we do at Rum Radio. We hope to help a couple of the starfish go on their way, and hopefully those starfish might be able to coax a couple other starfish on the way. So we pray that we're doing a good work. It has helped people. A personal knowledge that it saved somebody's life. Wow, that's pretty heady stuff. I'll tell you the story sometime. But it's that powerful. It helps thousands. And, you know, what a gift that is to have that opportunity to do that. So we're kind of excited. We have a lot of, you know what enthusiasm is? Harold, do you ever hear the word enthusiasm? You know that you've heard. Everybody's heard it there. It's the definition
yes.
of sale. It's the transference of enthusiasm. You like that? I like that.
Yes.
In through the God within you. That's what it means, to have the God within you. And that's so we're enthusiastic here at Rum Radio. So how you doing tonight, Harold?
I'm doing great. It's nice to be on. It's nice to have an opportunity to give back. I've received so much from the 12-step programs, and I consider it a privilege to give back. I want to tell our listeners that the only reason we're here is because Joseph has covered the cost of putting the website together years ago and the radio program. So this is not a money-making organization. He doesn't make a penny from it. It costs him quite a bit. But he does it as his way of giving back, and that's why we're all here tonight. So I'm looking forward to hearing from our guest tonight and hearing about recovery. What makes recovery really work is working with other people, and that's what the website's dedicated to, and the radio program as well. So let's see, the call-in number, 949-534-0621. That's 949-534-0621. Or you can go to the website, rumradio.org, rumradio.org, and press the microphone in the upper right corner. You'll go to the radio program, and you can participate. If you press the number 1, after you dial the number, you can ask your question. You can speak to the host. So I'll turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Do you know why we're all here, Harold? Do you know why we're all here?
I know why I'm here.
Well, we're all here because we're all not there.
That's it. Everyone's got to be...
AA is not a hotbed of mental health. Even those two can get well if they have the capacity to be honest. Well, I'd like to start on Chapter 5, and a disclaimer, this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. This is not CA, Cocaine's Anonymous. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. We're not affiliated with any 12-step group, although personally I'm a refugee from several 12-step programs. I like using the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it's the basic text. All the understanding of all the 12-step programs derive from that understanding found in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous called the big book. So I usually, I like to go to the basic template. I think Mark Twain said, learn it completely, and then you can change it as you wish. So that's what a lot of folks have done. They've learned the big book, really, and then they've changed it to their particular need. The interesting part about the 12 steps is that other than the first steps, all the other steps are just about the same. So, and the first step is the only step that mentions the addictive substance or problem. The other 11 steps talk about the solution. It's also called a design for living. So when I have a new sponsee and I say, well, and you finally get to share after you've worked step five, is that now you can talk to the solution. And remember, 11/12 of the program are the solution, 1/12 is the problem. We live in the solution and not in the problem. The problem is how we relate to each other. I give you this, experience, strength, and hope. This is what we share in our meetings. Experience is an inventory of our past mistakes. That's how we relate to each other. Strength is the ability to lift or carry. We lift our fellows and we carry the message of recovery. That helps keep us sober. And hope is the belief that our lives will continue to improve when we do the next right thing. And that next right thing is not to take that first drink of alcohol, that next shot of crack, the next shot of dope, and to trust in God and the process that he gave us. That's our hope. And it really works. It really does. I'm a living example of that process. Now, I have 17 years now. And I tell people that not to impress you, but it impresses the heck out of me. I shouldn't be here. I should either be dead or in jail or in an insane asylum or worse. So this is really quite a miracle. I tell folks we have guests that are of note because they have better jokes, and we also do the regular Joe because who can put a yardstick on a miracle? So before we get into our guest for tonight, that's Jacqueline R. Are you there, Jacqueline?
Yes, I am. Glad to be here tonight, Joseph.
Oh, thank you. I met Jacqueline at a local meeting at one of the local groups that I go to. Very articulate, very interesting, highly educated PhD lady. She knows the program. She's got a great story. You're going to be really interested. So if you just give me a minute, Jacqueline, I'd like to read how it works from the big book, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. You okay with that?
Sounds good to me, Joseph.
Thank you. All right, this is on Chapter 5 on How It Works, the big book, page 58. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Though those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. Sometimes I'll say blonde, but it's born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balk. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to the old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go. absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Most of us exclaimed, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Well, that's enough out of me. Would someone else like to talk about me? So, Jacqueline, tell us, well, as we laid that out, what it was like. Tell us what it was like. Can you do that?
I certainly will. I'll be glad to, Joseph. First of all, I want to say I don't think my story is very sad anymore like it was many, many years ago. So I've been in AA 19 and a half years. It'll be 20 years, June 26th, you know, because I started my program in AA on June 26, 1994. So I think there are a lot of really good things. I will go back, though, and tell you some of my story and how I got here and what happened. But I will also tell you that all these various degrees that I have, and, you know, that didn't help me so much because I was really trying to pursue things about recovery and addiction from the perspective of surely I could somehow control it or somehow I could figure out what to do or I could resolve something and not have to, you know, go to some of the 12-step programs. And so what happened was is over the years I realized that it was not possible. And I want to mention that I've not only worked the steps or the program in AA, I've also worked it in SDA because I helped start Spenders and Debtors Anonymous in 1987 here in Houston. And then I did the Workaholics Anonymous because I was such a terrible workaholic. I'd run from 90 hours a week to 120 hours a week. And, of course, I drank all that time, so then it really was a crazy time for me. And then January 4th, 1993, I went to Al-Anon for the second time. I had gone to Al-Anon because I had lived with an alcoholic for 12 years. You know, of course, I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I didn't look as bad as she did. and I could go to work and do stuff, which was ridiculous. So I left Al-Anon, unfortunately, after about 1984-85, and of course didn't go back until 93, but I'm very grateful to have worked that program as well and excited about the fact that I have 21 and a half years there. And Al-Anon really brought me to AA, which will be a part of my story in a moment. Another thing I want to mention is that I also went to Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. I was really a romance fantasy relationship addict, and I had with all the training that I had a lot of ability to talk and get people involved with me and get involved quickly and all that stuff, and then I'd wake up and think, oh, my God, what am I doing in this relationship? So it wasn't helpful. And then also in 2008 realized that I had issues with food, and so I went to Food Addicts in Recovery and have certainly worked that program. And then I've worked the steps on other things like control and thought addiction because I became so obsessive about a lot. So I believe that the 12 steps, the 12 traditions which teach me how to live in families and groups, and the 12 concepts which teach me how to live in organizations, I think the 12 steps, traditions, and concepts are a phenomenal way to learn how to live life differently. And I was a therapist for 18 years. I gave it up in 1991, and I created a new body of work, which I'll briefly talk about and later on. And what I know I've done is that I've started working in organizations even in different ways as a consultant, because I really try to apply the 12 steps, traditions, and concepts in all the work that I do on a daily basis. Now, let me just start with a little bit of history, Joseph. I grew up in Odessa, Texas, and my father was my father and mother did not drink, and I didn't know till much, much later, when my mother was very seriously ill, that she had been married to a violent alcoholic and got a divorce in 1929, which I think is a really gutsy thing on her part. But I didn't know it until much later in my life. But I think one of the things that I know is that my father was kind of this very serious businessman. He was very emotionally disconnected. He was awkward in personal relationships. He was a great entrepreneur, and he was on the city council, a lot of things. But he would say to people, you know, I think my wife and my daughter got me elected because they're well-known and they're much more pleasing to be around, you know, with people and interacting with them. My mother was, there were some things that were really a challenge with her as well. She was very emotionally unstable, and it's probably the reason that I went into the field that I went into to try to understand even more what happened over the years. But she went into treatment for a year for depression, and then when she came back, she was a much more valuable parent, and truly we got to be very, very good friends. She died at a very young age, though. She died at 65, which I consider to be young, and she had some real challenges in life, but she did not drink, and she was a big activist for people having respect and rights and a number of things. I remember her being very much against racism in the very early days. So she did impact a lot of the work that I do today about social justice and inclusion and diversity. But well, let me get
well,
back
you
to
have
9
a tremendous,
years.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Let's hear. I want to hear. Yeah, okay. That's a great background, though, to show very few people have that much information plus the education that you have. So that's really a benefit. I like to think the further down the scale we have gone. You ever hear the bigger the sinner, the greater the saint? The further down the scale we have gone, the more we can see how that experience can help others. So I believe the further down you went, the more you can help. So that gives you quite a broad brush to help a lot of folks. So I'm real interested
well,
to see. When was the first time?
Yeah, Joseph, one of the things I would say is that the 12 and 12 really got me to realize that I was an alcoholic, and it helped me a lot when we look at step one. And I think that I realized then how severe it was. If you'd like me to, I can go into a discussion of all the challenges I had while I was drinking and give a short summary of those and then go into more about the recovery I have today.
Yeah, well, let's do this. Let's do it like, you know, what it was like. So, you know, growing up, you touched on that a little bit. When was the first time? Was it drinking or drugs was the first thing that rang your bell? How old were you when you first took that drink and you knew something was up, or was it more of a progression?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that in my day, I'll be 72 in April. Now, I don't think I look 72. I feel about 58.
No, not at all. But, I'm surprised. Yeah.
But I am 72. And when I was about 5 years old, if you in my era, when you had a cough or something, they gave you a spoon of bourbon with sugar on it. And so my mother, you know, started giving me that at a very early age. So I remember about 5 years old of getting a stepladder and climbing up the cabinet and getting my spoon of sugar and bourbon at a very early age. So that's where I think I really started drinking. I don't think they had a clue, you know, that someday I would be a full-blown alcoholic. And so, it, you know, they didn't even think about it. And I think as the years went on, Joseph, you know, when I lived in their house, I didn't drink. But once I went to college, then I got out of their house, then I went crazy. And I almost didn't make it in my first year of college because it was, you know, I was a binge drinker.
Well, we did quite the leap between 5 years old and college. I'm sure there was something, any things happened that might be suggestive of alcoholism? Did you start drinking high school, junior high, just regular drinking? Were you drinking more than the other kids or anything like that?
The truth of it was I had about five times that I can recall, and I think I'm accurate, in that I took a spoon of sugar with bourbon. But from those times in my kind of elementary school years, when I did that, I was so afraid I'd get caught that I didn't do it again. And so I had one experience in high school when I drank, and there was this huge span of time where I didn't drink or do anything. And I had a lot of comments in the house where I live where mother and father both talked about how destructive alcohol was and how difficult it was. And I was so busy most of the time, Joseph, with other things that I didn't drink. And I didn't belong to groups in high school or junior high that did. And if they did, they took it away from me because they knew I didn't drink. So that happened.
Oh, okay.
But once I went to college, it was crazy. That's where I really started.
So you just – okay, so you were sequestered a little bit and in high school, parental, peer pressure. But going to college now, you're a free agent. Was that it?
Correct. And at that point, that's when I really started drinking. And I can recall I think that drove me to be a binge drinker where I'd start on Thursday nights and drink all the way through Sunday and then try to struggle, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday until Thursday night again. And I usually planned my schedule, you know, so that I wouldn't have too many classes on Friday or not too early on Monday so I could deal with it. And so that's how I did. And I... as the years went on, I graduated from college. I got married, went to Del Rio. My husband was in the Air Force, and so I started drinking every day. And I can remember.
How'd you meet your husband? Did you meet your husband through alcohol? Was there an alcohol bonding?
I met my husband through. We both lived in Odessa. And I knew him from high school, and we both went to the University of Texas in Austin, and so we started dating there.
Okay.
And we drank, but, we didn't think it was so awful. I know today that it was because in those years that I was married to him, I remember getting very concerned because I was intoxicated for a week at a time, or I would stop, I'd stop drinking for a while and get really scared and try to binge drinking again and try to control it. And then I do remember waking up on a Sunday morning and thinking, I have a serious problem because I counted the number of cans of beer that we had had the night before, and I could match my husband easily when we drank. And I'd had a case and a half of beer and then double margaritas when we went to Mexico and passed up.
Oh, my goodness.
Know.
Yeah, you little girls always shock me. I'm such a wimp when it came to drink. I've known a couple girls like you. I would just be so amazed at how much you could put away. It was like an empty piss. You know, I'd be going cross-eyed and it's just getting started, you know. I guess it's a lot of metabolism.
I don't know what it was, but I can tell you this. I prided myself in being able to drink like a guy, and so, you know, I made certain that I could do that. And, of course, I knew that I passed drunk. One of the interesting things about my alcoholism is I remembered everything. I did not have space outs, or what you call blackouts. I didn't have them.
Blackout,
so I remembered every crappy thing I ever did. So it wasn't very pleasant when
good.
I got drunk. Well, I don't know if it's good or bad, Joseph, because there are moments where dancing on tables in Mexico and doing a lot of crazy stuff, I'm not sure that I was pleased. And I did have some comments from friends about my behavior, so I'm not sure. I made a lot of amends for that. But let me say this, though, that
sure.
I'll tell you a place in the big book that really made a lot of difference for me, Joseph. On page 31 in paragraph 2, you know, where it talks about all the alcohol and drugs and what do we use and try to keep and switch. Years, I switched from bourbon to rum to gin to vodka to scotch, and I thought if I drank scotch because I couldn't stand, then I would stop drinking, and I didn't. I stopped drinking tequila because I got so sick at various points. And I think the thing that I would like to mention to people is that I'm healthier today at 71 and just a month from now, 72, than I've ever been in my life. I had I smoked 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day. I drank extremely heavy for many, many, many years. And what I did is that I think that I contributed to several illnesses. I had what they called a light stroke when I was 29, and I was paralyzed for a period of time and had to do physical therapy. And then I had a total hysterectomy when I was 32, and I think all those serious illnesses began because of all that I was doing to myself. The other thing that I know that my education didn't help me stop drinking, Joseph, because the truth of it is that I knew I couldn't drink. I started taking homeopathics, trying everything else to not have hangovers. And then I would try to control it. And when I went to AA, I was drinking 2-3 glasses of wine every 3 weeks, controlling it to the nth degree and being miserable and knowing I wanted more. But every time I drank, I got very, very sick. So I knew that my body was really poisoned by the alcohol. And so, finally, on June 25th, and not, the day before June 26th, which I count my day of sobriety, I realized that I had to do something, that I'd been to a lot of other 12-step programs, and even my sponsor in Al-Anon asked me when we got to the finishing the 5th step, he said, Jacqueline, do you have anything else to tell me that you think you need to know? And I used to go home and pray about it, and I came back and I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And so he was the one, my Al-Anon sponsor was the one that said, why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And so I started, I talked to him, I remember, on a Thursday, and I went to a meeting, on the 26th.
You know, I tell my sponsees, if you really want to be a good AA sponsor, go to Al-Anon. But I've heard it both ways, where I consider Al-Anon sort of like postgraduate AA, but it's a fairly common story, not a common, but I've heard it quite a few times where people have started in Al-Anon thinking that the other person had all the problem and then realized that they had the problem also.
Well, I think that my partner that I was involved with at the time for those 12 years looked so dreadful compared to me. She was the picture I had of a serious alcoholic, just falling down drunk, not being able to go to work, doing a lot of things like that and creating havoc. And I didn't see myself doing that because I was continuing to work and had the cars and the houses and all the things that it goes with. I think the thing that really brought me to my knees was that I ended up in a really difficult court case starting in 1991, and it started in 87 and went until 94, and it cost me $500,000, and it brought me to my knees because it really showed me the severity of my alcoholism by the choices I've made with people that I've been involved with, my business partners. Many things really showed me how severe it was. And so that's really what brought me to recovery.
And then, okay, so then you get into, now you were lucky in a sense that you went to Al-Anon. So your bottom really was your relationship, right? You bottomed in a relationship, went to Al-Anon, right? How did you hear about Al-Anon? Or did you just happen to know about it? Or how did you find out about that there was a thing called Al-Anon?
Well, let me answer that first in saying I think I bottomed out when that court case started. I lost the funds I had. I lost a lot of things in my life at that point, and I could see how the alcoholism was destroying me. I went to Al-Anon because a friend had told me, you know, you don't have any business living with this person. She's a terrible alcoholic, and you don't seem to be able to see it, and you're so invested in helping everyone and keeping her afloat, you need to go to Al-Anon. So I started going in 1983. I didn't stay, you know, because I got rid of her, and so I thought I didn't have a problem, which is crazy. In 93, I was in the midst of that court case, and I began to realize that I was just miserable and that I had to do something. And I'll admit that I think I was so resistant to accepting that I was an alcoholic, it was easier for me to go to Al-Anon. And, of course, alcohol was addressed there. So it started really causing me to think about what was going on, Joseph. And so I think that's what happened. My comment would also be is that I think it's tragic how a lot of members of AA will not go to Al-Anon. I look at it this way. If I'm an alcoholic and I'm dealing with alcoholics or I'm dealing with work addicts or other types of addiction, I need to know how to be healthy in relationships with them, and that's what Al-Anon teaches. It teaches me how to be in the presence of addiction. And so, you know, I think that's I really am appreciative of the years I've spent in Al-Anon and how it got me to AA.
That's way too reasonable, it's way too logical, and way too far over most folks' heads. They really don't get that concept. They look at the Al-Anon as a party pooper. Although I have to say this is, if you really want to have a good time in Al-Anon, you need a couple alcoholics in there. Otherwise, it gets a little dry.
Now, Joseph, wait a minute. You know, I know it's your radio show, but let me tell you something. I do a lot of laughing, and I do a lot of fun in Al-Anon. So I'll tell you what, I need to tell you about the meetings I go to so you can have some fun with me, okay?
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, the other thing I want to mention to you is I met, I can't think of his name now, but he had been in the community a long time. I think when I heard him, he had 50-something years in, and I don't know if he's still alive, but he had 50 years, something like close to that, in AA. He said, you know, I go to AA because it teaches me how to stop drinking and also to live life differently. But he said, I really go to Al-Anon because that really teaches me how to live the principles every day of my life. And I think he's right. There are things that I'm taught in Al-Anon, like learning how to detach from someone's addiction, that helped me to be a much better sponsor for people. And I really enjoy sponsoring. It's a very important part of my recovery.
Oh, good. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. That's what I said. I tell them, you know, I'm an Al-Anon. I do both programs. I learned that early on that was necessary to be a good AA sponsor, and I deal with a lot of alcoholics, and I needed those tools in and out of the program. I have children that have problems, and it's just a good, even if you don't have anybody, you got somebody, let me tell you. Most folks don't realize there's a dysfunction of something going on with most folks, you know, whether it's eating, sex, relationships, gambling, I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on. Everyone has something. I believe everyone, to some degree, is a natural codependent. You're dependent on something or someone. And this gives you tools to deal with those distractions that keep you from having a joyous and free life. But that's my two cents. Anyway, this is your story.
Yeah, but I support you in what you're saying. I really think, you know, I've looked at it. I've been in business 40 years working with people, and I honestly think that everybody that I've ever experienced in those 40 years, they have some kind of addictive process. Now, I will admit that I've developed a way to call it habitual patterns sometimes to get them to even think about what the issues are, but I have most of the work I do today is with people that have a clear addiction. And I personally, I don't think some of the, there are two kinds of addictions. There's the substance addictions that we take in stuff, like alcohol, drugs, and nicotine and so forth. And then there's the process addictions like work and control and being polite to the point that, you know, you're not honest with people. And I think all those are cunning and baffling, and they're difficult to deal with. One of the things that I find valuable in the sponsorship work I do, not just the work I do daily with clients of mine, but one of the things I find valuable as a sponsor is I know a lot about different programs, and sometimes it's very helpful when I sponsor someone in AA or Al-Anon.
Well, okay, let's go back now. Okay, so you finished up Al-Anon. You've decided that AA, you find an AA meeting, you go in there. Do you grab a sponsor right away? Does the sponsor find you? How did that work?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, my story, the morning I went to go to the meeting, is really important to me. So I'm glad you asked that, and then I want to go to the sponsorship. I got up that morning on June 26th, and I wanted to go to a meeting. And there were two on Main Street and in Houston, Texas. And I got in my car, and I was going to go with a friend of mine. And she called me and said, "I can't go," and I feel dreadful. And I said, "Don't worry about it. I've been in recovery for a while in other programs. I know how to get into a meeting." Well, the interesting thing was, I left my house. Because I live in the Museum District, I went down Main Street, and I got to the first church, and because I got so panicked, I couldn't get out. It was like all those years of resisting, wanting to admit that I was an alcoholic were just paralyzing, so I couldn't get out of the car. So then I thought, well, I'll go down, I'll just drive down to the next church, and maybe I can get out. And so I got down to Christ Church Cathedral, and I was driving around trying to find a parking place. And I saw a police officer, and I stopped him and I said, "Look, I need," and I don't know why I was so honest, but I did. I laughed today about it. But anyway, I said, I've got to go to an AA meeting. I need to go to Bill, to be a part of Bill W.'s group, and I've got to go find that meeting over there. And he looked at me, and he said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "I'm a member of Bill W.'s group, too. Here's the parking place where you need to go. Go up the third floor. Come down this elevator. I'll meet you down there. I'll meet you exactly at this point. I'll take you over to the meeting, and I'll get you in the room." And, I think it's a God thing, because what happened was...
Oh, no, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Yeah. That was an angel for you.
Yeah, and it was an angel for me, because then I got to the door, and it was at a school, and you had to get permission to get through the locked door. And he said to the woman, "This woman needs to go to the meeting that's down in the basement." And then he went down with me. The interesting thing was, when I got out of the meeting, I looked for him, and of course he wasn't there.
You never saw him again.
Yeah, and I thought, is this a figment of my imagination? Am I crazy? have I been drinking? I didn't drink the day before, so I thought, what's going on with me? And
you never saw him before again, right? After that was it. He just disappeared.
But I tell you, I do know that because I asked one of my friends the next week that when I went to the meeting, I said, "I did bring a police officer down." He said, "Yes, you did." So I know that. About finding sponsorship, I will tell you this. I was in the midst of that court case, and when I walked into my first meeting, I thought it was not funny that God had sent me to a meeting where 92% of the people in the room were lawyers. And I thought, this is not funny at all. I thought, this is ridiculous. And later on,
that just goes to prove, I've said at meetings before that, especially to the new person, I just, we have people from Penn State and the state pen. We have doctors. We have people that are just recently off the streets. We have people that are just on loan from the insane asylum. I says, we're so inclusive, we even allow attorneys in here.
Thank you. Well, I tell you, they were very helpful to me because when I got to the amends process, they saved me because they helped me negotiate to some things, and they did a lot of things for me. And you know, I did some anonymous contributions that were very helpful, and they gave me some great suggestions. I do want to tell you, though, I think I went to my meeting for about 6 weeks, and then, you know, people started talking to me about who did I want as my sponsor. And I went to a big book study, and there was a man named Mark H., and I was just amazed. And I went up to him, and I said, I want to talk to you about sponsorship. And he'd heard part of my story when we were talking. He said, you have a PhD and you want me to sponsor you. And I said, look, you have serenity and peace, and I don't have that. I don't know how to get it, and I don't care what your best is. I want to know how you do this program because you're doing something that's very different, and I've been in other recovery programs and it hadn't mattered. And he was a tremendous sponsor. I'm so grateful to him. He has a study guide for the big book that's very detailed that goes into every sentence. And we did that study guide together. We worked the steps together. I went to, for many years that he was alive, for I don't know how many years, 10 or 12 or whatever it was that we started.
He did the study guide? What's the study guide's name? What is it? How do I find it?
It's a study guide that he created, and I tried to use it today. And it's a very well-done study guide, but it's based on a lot of study that he did with a group in Dallas. And then, of course, he was at La Hacienda for years. But I often use that. I think it's a great program.
I think I know what you're talking about. It's they had formalized it. It's a study guide where they ask a question, and then
correct.
The next sentence in the big book answers the question.
Correct. And what he did was he had two versions of it. He had that version you're talking about, and then he had the version where he did some more intricate work that he did because he did big book studies almost every weekend. And there were a lot of weekends that I went with him and talked with him. And I'm grateful, you know. And I was resistant to reading the big book because I thought it, you know, I've been a big feminist for years and an activist and all this stuff. And I hated it because it had all he's and it only had I didn't think they had enough women's stories in it and things like that. And so he taught me so much about the big book and how alive it was and the way he taught me to read it. You know, he taught me, put your name in every place it is, Jacqueline. Put your name in it. I don't care if it applies to you. Put your name in it when it mentions a name, and then you'll see how it applies to you. And, you know, he created it was alive. Now, I did two other things that I want to mention. I started smiling when you read how it works, and I love hearing that. Because one day he said to me, you know, I don't know if you're constitutionally capable of being honest with yourself because you were so damn resistant to reading the big book because you want to change it all the time. And he said, I want you to read how it works every day. And so for a year, I read how it works every day for a year and asked myself, am I constitutionally capable of being honest enough to let go of my rebellion and to really work this program? And it was a phenomenal help. The other thing he had me do, and I think it's because of my education, but I find it helpful with any of my sponsees, he had me read the doctor's opinion. He would say, okay, tell me the page that it says you have to have a psychic change. Now tell me, what does that mean to you, and how are you going to have to do that as you work these steps? And he would ask that constantly, and it was extreme help for me. And today I love the big book. I love working with sponsees because I learn something every time we read it again.
That reminds me of a story I heard in a meeting one time. He said this fellow said that my sponsor wanted me to become a sponsor. I had worked the steps, and he said it's your turn now to give back. You need to find a sponsee and start taking them through. And he said, look, he says, there's no way I'm going to know the big book as well as you do. He says, anytime I ever had a problem, I would call you up and you would tell me what page to find the solution in the big book. He says, I've read the big book. He says, but there's no way I'll ever know it as well as you did. And I said, you know, I give you a problem with living or however, and you tell me the page. And the sponsor said, I just gave you arbitrary numbers. You found what you were looking for. Now go sponsor somebody.
Good for him. Good for him. And, you know,
but we, just,
you
we
know,
really
one,
do
you know,
find
one
what
thing,
we're looking for.
One thing.
Well,
excuse me. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, we really do find what we're looking for. And if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, you put it in the big book. A lot of folks, they, you know, I tell people that the question comes up, is the big book based on Bible, on the King James or on the Bible? And I said, well, I really don't know, but I know they both came from the same place. The key
Yeah, they're both spiritual. And Joseph, I want to say something to you, though, about the big book. I don't have any doubt in my mind that Bill Debbie was just channeled the big book from, a higher power. There's no way that someone could write what he did without it being channeled by a higher power.
Oh, no. The spiritual concept is God uses the weak things of this world to accomplish his ends. Through small means,
right.
He does these things. And Bill would be right there. Bill was right there, you know. So he used Bill to get it. And one of the ways you can see if a work is spiritual or not, I call it, we have a big book fairy. Do you know about the big book fairy? Comes at night and puts things in the big book that you've never seen before. You don't know where it came from. You've read the book before, and all of a sudden, there it is. And the point is that as you start to grow spiritually, the eyes of your understanding open. The book becomes living. And that's how you could tell it's spiritual, because as you grow spiritual, so does the understanding in the book. Remember, it says we grow spiritually, we grow in understanding and in effectiveness. That's how we know it's spiritual.
And I appreciate the spiritual fairy, because I have read the big book so many times, and I'll go over with a new sponsor and I'll think, I swear that sentence wasn't in there, so I'll just take it. It's the
big spiritual book
fairy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I do want to.
A lot of people
they
don't know that.
Something. Huh?
A lot of people don't know. There's a Bible fairy, too. He does the same thing with the Bible. A very busy fairy.
Well, I can tell you, one of the things I really love about the big book is that I have started using the concordance that, you know, you can get at AA Intergroup. And when I have a problem, then I just look up the word, and then I go look at it and see what it brings to me and what the understanding is. And over the years, I have lots of notebooks where I've led to AA meetings or done something, and I have topics, and I have several notebooks that have the topics I've covered and kind of the literature that I've looked at and things like that, and I continue to look at new words or new things that challenge me and find the answer either in the 12 and 12 or the big book.
I like to think – yeah, go ahead.
Your turn.
I like to think of the there's a scripture that goes, in the mouth of the second witness, the matter shall be established. And I believe that's a spiritual law, and it's a temporal law, because it's what we call a corroborating witness. If you go up on the stand, someone has to validate what you just said, otherwise it's your word against mine. You need a corroboration. So I believe the 12 and 12 is that second witness to the big book. I think it validates the big book as a spiritual work. Now, a lot of people, I know some big book thumpers, and they, you know, they cringe when they hear the 12 and 12, and I remind them on page 164, it says, we know so little. This book is only meant to be suggestive. More shall be disclosed. So what do you want to do? You want to know less? You know, like, it's okay. The 12 and 12 is the experience of those people who use the big book over a 12-year period. So you have an experience to validate the information. But anyway, that's my two cents.
Well, you know, one of the things that I see about it is that, the big book is the basis of our program, and it gives the foundation of, what it is. But I think it's really important that AA members understand that the 12 steps helped me work on myself and truly change myself and become a spiritual being and a living and live in the process of my life every day and be accountable for it. The traditions, though, which are addressed in the 12 and 12, they really helped me learn how to live with groups and families and really be appropriate in my interactions. And then, as I mentioned before, the 12 concepts teach me how to live in organizations and how to be more productive in AA and how to really contribute to the program. And so I'm very grateful that Bill W., added to his knowledge base of what's happened. The thing that helps me in step one is I didn't see myself as a skid row drunk. I wasn't there. I still had the house and the cars and whatever. But where he hit me between the eyes was, in step one of the 12 and 12. And it made me realize that I didn't have to be a certain kind of alcoholic to be a real alcoholic and go to AA. So I think there's a lot of great information in there. And
None of it should be dismissed. I mean, the messages from the heart and Dr. Bob and the good old timers, we have a lot of really good information. Actually, to get someone through the steps, the big book will do that if it's done in a timely manner. I believe the other information is necessary because we've strung the process out. So the longer it takes, the more information that's going to be required.
Right. And another thing I think too is, when you get to steps, six and seven, you don't have a lot of information in the big book, but it really brings it to full light in the 12 and 12. And I think six is, what I run into with my sponsees is that where they quit is before four, or they quit in six and seven. And I think the reason that they, and I'm not saying all my sponsees do that, but the ones that do quit or don't stay in the program, because we have those. I mean, I have to accept that they're there.
Yeah, sure.
But I think the problem is you get to six, you say, okay, these are my character defects. Do I really want to give them up, and do I really want to become this person that shows these assets? And I think people, they struggle over it, and they don't want to give it up, and then they don't want to turn it over to God fully and accept that part their higher power. Excuse me, my higher power is God.
Let me give you what I've discovered on that, because I've had the same problem. I get them to five, and four or five is really a lot of work. I mean, this is the hubcap of the program. Five tells us, having had a spiritual awakening, five. Step five, I'm having a brain fart there. Until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So that's directing us to not only speak a fifth step, but to hear a fifth step. But the key in there is that it's the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So now on step five, the sponsee has got a kinship with God. So all the stuff that he's not drinking, he's gotten a spiritual kinship with God right now, and you know what? And I'm less than halfway through, I'm good. I have a life again. I'm working. I might have a girlfriend or a wife or a relationship. I got a business going. How about six? Well, I'm good. I believe that's my experience, is that once you get them to five, you got to get them to six right away. You could do six right there, and then now they're more than halfway through, and I think that's really the key. I'm an alcoholic. I'm always looking for that easier, softer way. And once I've reached that plateau. I got a kinship with God. I got all this thing off my chest. I'm feeling pretty good. I'm really good. And how about now I have to do some more work? I'm not really all that interested right now. So wait, after I wax the cat, you know, now I want to rest on my laurels. I call it restless laurelitis. You know, I went through the fourth to fifth step. That monkey's off my back. You know, I feel really good about myself. And, oh, now we have to dig a little deeper. Not right now.
Well, I think there's one thing. The reason I was mentioning the 12 and 12 and how important it is because I think that one of the things I've found really helpful when somebody wants to stop is I say, don't stop right now. I want you to reach 6 in the 12 and 12, and let's look at what that really is going to bring you and be able to talk about it. So that's the way I've been able to, you know, and then get 7 because it's more detailed.
Right.
But I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly, but what I think they're feeling better, they've gotten all that off their chest, and they, you know, why should I go on? And, you know, another place I see people stopping is before 8 and 9. They may make part of the list, but when they realize that this is the thing where they're going to go talk to somebody, they don't want to do it. And I've seen the results of it.
Yeah, cross the fiery bridge with humility and an olive branch. I wrote that up. And it's a fiery bridge. You know, people don't like the idea that, you know, okay, if we start out, it's, you know, just me, and then it's me and a sponsor, me a sponsor and God. Now it's me, a sponsor, God, and somebody I stung before. You know, now I have to go, now it's real humility now. Now it takes a lot. There's one of the stories on the website, and it's a true story. Danny B., he's a circuit speaker now. He was in my home group in Austin. He's here in Houston somewhere. I hadn't seen him in years. But he's a circuit speaker, and he tells a story where he was the third man in a felony robbery, and he got away. The other two guys got caught, but they couldn't find him. And I know his sponsor, John Henry, in Austin. That's not his last name. John told him that if he wanted to get sober, he had to turn himself in because he had gone so far down the scale. Now, I don't know, everybody, you know, that's a spiritual deal. He was so determined to go to any length as he agreed to in the beginning, and that's where this sponsor directed him. He wasn't married. See, that was the key. If he was married, then that would not have been a good idea because he would have hurt an innocent party. But there was nobody to hurt other than him, and we got to take whatever it takes. So he went to the police officer, and he told him, he said, I'm working an AA program, and I'm the third man in that robbery. You know what the detective told him?
He probably told him
the man who did that robbery would have not admitted it. Why don't you go home?
Right. Right.
And Danny says, right. I'm in for life. I'm in AA for life. So it's that kind of faith that's required.
Well, let me say something to you, Joseph. There was a part of the court case was really had a lot of nasty aspects to it that it could be very damaging to me. And at the time, and so what happened was, because I had so many friends in AA at my meeting that were lawyers, they helped me find ways to resolve issues. And literally, I went to someone and talked in detail about some of the business practices that I didn't feel comfortable with, and the man looked straight at me, and he said, I hear what you're saying, and he said, I am so glad you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, you just keep working your program, and when you get to your amends, you make some of those payments you're talking about, and you go on with your life, and I have nothing more to say to you. And it could have been very, I'm not going into a lot of detail about it, but it could have been a very difficult situation for me. I could have lost license. I could have lost a lot of stuff, and it didn't happen. And I think by the grace of, you know, God, period, and by working the program constantly and by talking to people in a different way and living a different way, people saw that I meant what I really that I meant what I said, and, you know, I took the actions to prove that. So I'm very clear that, you know, I was directed all along. And I laugh, you know, I laugh many times today when I think about all those lawyers sitting in the room in that first meeting. And thank God they were there because they just helped me all along to understand what I could do. You know, I remember going into the meeting one day. This is the benefit of not even knowing what you're doing, but you just have the faith that you've got to go do something and take the right action and go to that meeting and stay there. And one day I was really very disturbed and was really demoralized because I'd just been reamed for about a two-week period in court. And some of the guys came up to me afterwards and said, let me tell you about that lawyer. Let me tell you about what's going on. Let me tell you the games that are being played. And let me tell you how to handle that and really deal with it differently, Jacqueline. And but that's another thing that I don't think people realize. AA is a phenomenal resource of people. There's very seldom a time that if I have a difficulty that I can't find somebody to talk to that has had a similar problem, worked through it, or done something about it. I mean, that's a great experience in itself, is the fellowship and how we can support each other.
That's a great story. So what do you do now? So now this is, you work 10, 11, and 12 on a regular basis. I take it if you're sponsoring, you usually have to do that. You got to pray a lot when you sponsor people, that's for sure.
You know, periodically I will work the steps again. I finished the steps about a month ago, and I've worked the steps. I've been in recovery. I count my real recovery beginning in 1987 when I started Spenders and Debtors, because I really worked the program through that. I mean, I went through all the way through 12 steps in that program, and I went through 12 steps in each one of the programs I mentioned. Today, yeah, I do. I make an agreement with myself that if I've done something, I need to immediately stop, pause when I'm really agitated, process through my feelings, figure out whether I need to make an amends or not, and immediately do it. And I feel grateful for it. And I give myself no longer than 24 hours. If I feel very uncomfortable about something, I need to get clarity. I do have a woman that we kind of co-sponsor each other now, which is very comfortable for both of us. And I check it out with her or my other recovery people. And so I keep working on it. And I do stay in 10, 11, and 12. But periodically, if I think that there's a problem and I just can't get over it, I'll tell you one thing I did that was really not smart, Joseph. One day I got really upset about something that was going on in a board meeting that I had and with a person, and I sent an email that I thought was going to the president and went to the very person I was talking about, and it was awful. It created such a horrible situation, and I was so embarrassed. And I knew immediately that I needed to make an amends to the board members because I had created so much difficulty. And I called my, co-sponsor at the time, and we just started, you know, it's something I do all the time when I have a serious problem. I started step one, and she just said, okay, how are you powerless and your life's unmanageable about this situation? We went all the way through 12 steps, and by the time we'd gotten through, I had clarity about what I needed to do. And I took those actions and made the amends and went on, you know.
What I found in step 10, that it's easier to swallow crow while it's still warm, because once it gets cold, it has the bitter aftertaste of regret.
Thank you. That's beautiful. That is great. And I guess that's the reality of it, because I did something with a woman I've been working with as a friend of mine. And in 10 minutes, I thought, how in the world could you do that? You've been in recovery a long time. What are you doing? And I called her, and she couldn't talk to me right then. She said, just write me, Jacqueline. It's really okay. I said, no, it's not okay. You know my program. She said, okay, write it to me. And I just sat down and wrote her an email and said, you know, here's what I did. I was rude, and I was argumentative on the phone, and I feel dreadful about it. You know, I've been friends for years, And what I'm going to do next time is I am going to pause when agitated. I'm going to say, could I please get back on the phone with you later? I've got to process through some things and talk with you and so that this will work more effectively. So it's easy for me to name what I've done, tell how I feel and show some remorse, and then talk about how I'm going to change it. And I would never, never have done that if I hadn't been in a 12-step program.
So now what keeps you maximum service to God and your family? Now you do sponsorship. That's where most people end. And you have a professional business that kind of does a synergy between recovery and the 12-step process?
Well, first of all, I love sponsoring, and I feel it's a real honor and privilege. Some of my Al-Anon friends call me a black belt sponsor because I'm really pretty tough with people. Because I think we volunteer our time. My sponsors were really clear with me. By the way, I had two male sponsors, and I love both of them. My Al-Anon sponsor was male, and also my AA sponsor was male. And what they said to me was, well, my Al-Anon sponsor, about into 6 weeks of working together, I was arguing with him about something. He said, let me ask you something. What's the reason you chose me? I said, well, because you have serenity and I don't. And I did the same thing with my AA sponsor, same thing I wanted. And he said, well, do you think I have things to offer you that you could benefit from? I said, yes, sir, I believe that. And he said, well, you're arguing with me about my suggestion. Are you going to go take it or not? I said, yes, I will definitely take it. And I will go do exactly what it was. And what he was asking me to do was pause when agitated and not take any action for 24 hours. And I was in misery. I mean, I was in misery about it. And so,
yes.
And so I called him I called him at 24 hours and 1 minute. And he said, you're still not ready. And I said, oh, no, no. But anyway, I started, just stopping rebelling and doing what he asked me, and it helped tremendously. And that's part of it. The other part is, yes, in 1991, well, I was never a very traditional therapist anyway, because I always shared my experiences and all kinds of things, and so I was very different. Most people said that they'd never been to anybody quite like me, because I was much more transparent. But anyway, in 1991, I went to a program that was really about recovery and about living life differently. And when I came back, I just knew that I never wanted to do traditional work again. And so in 1991, in that period of 91 to 92, I started creating a body of work that we call Synergy today, C-E-N-T-E-R-G-Y. And what it is it's really very much oriented toward taking responsibility for our addictive processes, really emotionally connecting to our behavior patterns and changing them, and really working toward living life on life's terms and living in the process of life. And I shocked a lot of people because they all saw me as this therapist, and I walked into my office, huge office on that Augusta one day, and just said, we're going to do something different. We're going to learn how to process feelings. And I love my work today. I think it's much more compatible with recovery because I'm not there using therapy techniques or anything like that. It's not peer counseling. A lot of people try to name it that. We just had a weekend experience, and people said it was an amazing process, and they learned more than they ever had. I think it's very humbling for me because I don't use any of the techniques anymore. I have eliminated them from the work I do. And I don't think people see me in the same way. I tried to defrock myself by not calling myself a doctor and doing all kinds of things to try to get people to see me as a human being, as a therapist, and they just didn't. Because the term itself puts kind of a connotation or a view in people's minds. And I think people appreciate what I share with them today, and they're respectful of it. But they see me more as human, and I think I'll just give you an example. I was working, and I don't call them clients anymore. I call them participants in my work. And I was working with somebody the other day. He said, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about you, and I said, no. And I said, I'd love to hear what is it now? Because you've told me many times about things you appreciate. And he said, you have always been honest with me. If you're having a difficulty, you know, the first thing you'll say to me is, look, here's briefly what's going on in my life. You know, I want you to know that if you feel something that's very odd about my energy today, it's not about you, it's about me. If I have a sharp tone of voice with you, please remind me. Because I'm working on something, and I'm going to work through this. And he said, you know, my parents didn't do this. My parents projected everything in the world onto me. And he said, that's what ended up, and I ended up, you know, being in both AA and CA. And he said, you know, I'm very grateful for you to do that. So I love my work today. I think it's much more honest. It teaches people really how to process through their feelings, change their behaviors, and do a number of things. I'm well known for being confronted, but I think I'm compassionate, but I have limits, you know, on what I'm willing to accept as reasonable interactions or behavior. And I personally think it's very valuable. Joseph, you asked me when we started talking about me being on this radio show. I do have a website. It's Cloud, C-L-O-U-D hyphen Radishek, R-A-I-N-O-S, like Sam, E-K, .com. And I would encourage people to go out there and see more of what we do. If you go to the, there's some radio shows that I've done before that really talk about the work that we do. We have an online 17 behavioral grouping inventory that is, looks at habitual patterns. Now, for those of us in recovery, you're going to recognize immediately it's about alcohol and about drugs and about work and a lot of things. But people find that habitual patterns assessment to be extremely valuable because it helps them look at, and the reason I started it, Joseph, was because I saw people relapsing all the time, and I thought, what can I do? How can I get them to be aware of what their behavior patterns are when they sober up? You know, what can I do to help them? And this assessment shows the entirety of how habitual patterns or addictions work together to create misery in people's lives. And so I've seen some improvement in people staying in programs longer and also, staying sober and really working through the program. And some of the people I've experienced have really difficult problems. Currently, we're doing a validation study, and honestly, it's free to take the assessment. And you can go online and go to our website and ask if you want to take the assessment. It's free. We give you a report, and then one of my stuff gets on the phone with you and talks about the report and what it shows to you. So I think our work is very compatible with recovery, and we're very supportive. And there's really not anybody in our work that is not in a recovery program today. They may come in and not be in recovery, but ultimately they'll end up in either, you know, going to Al-Anon or something else when we find out what the major issues are for them.
That sounds great. Give me the website again. Would you do that?
Sure. It's Cloud, C-L-O-U-D, hyphen, Rainoshek, R-A-I-N-O-S, EK.com.
Now, Cloud is your partner, right? She's your partner?
Yes, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious because when I made the wordplay on the title, but it was a rain cloud. And go like, oh.
Yes, well, we've had that before.
It's
yeah,
sort of like a yeah, synergy.
Lisa and I have been together. We're not only business partners, we're life partners. We've been. She came into my life after I got sober.
Ah.
So.
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard it before, but I thought there was a kind of there was a connection there. I guess like a serendipity. What I've What I've discovered is that serendipity, synchronicity, and coincidence are all but God incognito.
Correct. It's a wonderful statement, Joseph. You're right on. And,
Thank you.
You know, I don't think, I don't, Liz is also in recovery. She does her own program. I don't think I would have her in my life today. I think she would say the same thing if we had not been working our program. And we do that. My son, you know, our son is also in recovery in a large portion of our family. In fact, you can't work as an associate in Cloud Radishek unless you are in recovery.
Oh, cool. Harold,
yeah,
do you have any last words?
Oh, good.
Yeah, I would think that if at that level of recovery that you've gone on to the level of synergy trying to take on these other issues. And relapse is quite a deal. I put it to you this way. The newcomer is life's blood to AA, just like the old-timer is the backbone. But relapse is the soul because there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. And, you know, you've been around long enough to know we see people with long-term sobriety, short-term sobriety go back out, and in a very short period of time, some barely make it in and some don't make it back in at all. They die. There's a lot of deaths unnecessarily in the rooms of recovery. We hate it. You know, we dislike it when a comrade dies. You know, we're all glad it's not us, but, you know, we're always trying to figure out, hey, what could have we done differently? I think that's just the natural scheme of things. I had recently a sponsee die, and the father called me up to thank me for the work that I did with him. I hadn't heard from him in a while, but that was our regular deal. You know, we took him to the steps twice. He had a relapse. But the good news was, if there is such a thing with good news with that, for all appearances, it seems that he died from an illness, and it wasn't alcohol. He died
good.
Sober.
Good. I'm glad not. Yeah.
You know,
well, you know,
and I was going to say I have my little quirk about that. If you die still in your disease, and I believe that this is also a disease of mind, body, and spirit, and the spiritual component of it is that you no longer have a body to go through withdrawal. So your spirits kind of hung out to dry, but that's only a supposition on my point, but something to consider. So when I hear someone died and they died sober, it's probably I feel kind of a relief to know, you know, everybody, the 155,000 people die every day, but to die sober once you were an alcoholic or a drug addict is quite the accomplishment. You were going to say?
No, I really love the way you said that. I really love the way you said that. I think that is so right on. And what a wonderful way to say it. Because, you know, I've always felt very sad when I know that somebody went back out and then they die. And I feel such sadness. And I think your statement is excellent. One of the things I would say is that, interestingly enough, the habitual patterns assessment and the knowledge it brings to people and how their alcoholism interacted with their need to control things and to be overly invested in relationships to the point that then they get sexually addictive and then they end up drinking again because they created a problem, or that they work because they want to get more money for their drugs and alcohol, and they don't realize how all these various addictions fit with each other. And I've had so many people sit down with me and say, you know, and I'm not talking about people that, you know, that are ones that are not even in recovery, say, my gosh, this just tells me everything about what I'm doing, and I have a chance now that I know the behavior patterns, I can really look at them and look at how I can work with them. In fact, one of my sponsees said to me, she'd heard about the assessment, and we were in 4 and 5, and she'd gone through it, and she was going through 6 and 7. She said, I heard about that assessment. I want to take it. And I said, okay. And so we took it, and we went through it, and she said, oh, my gosh, look at my step 4 and 5, and look at how this shows me this. And she said, it adds some stuff that I didn't realize. And she said, then I can add some things in my to my list of character defects and shortcomings and I can look at how I can change those. And then she said, and all of that, I have some ways that I can tell some people when I get to my men about behaviors I did, and I didn't have any clarity about it. So anyway, I do think.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I do. And, I, you know, again, I want to mention we're doing a validation study right now, so it's free. So you get a, you know, you get a chance to go through a, it's online, it's easy to take, takes maybe 20, 25 minutes to take it. We get a report, then one of us will call them back and talk to them about it. So it's a great way to look at it. And we'd like some more people to take it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, the key to this thing is getting the word out. I mean, that's the key. And then the alcoholic and the drug addict are basically, and I speak for myself, a little on the lazy side, restless laurelitis, I call it, you know, resting on our laurels, you know. I'm not drinking, I'm not drugging, I'm helping other people, leave me alone, enough already. I said this to some people at church 2 weeks ago. I said, you know, I didn't really want to come to church today. I kind of said to myself, you know, I'm tired of being good all the time. They looked at me. I belong to a fundamentalist group.
Well, let me say this, Joseph. You know, I'm happy to not have as much stress as I've had in the past, and I can tell you that I have a radar out. I can feel people's energy, and I know when they're in an addictive cycle. And so I've learned how, thank God through Al-Anon, to separate myself out from it. But I'm really grateful for the serenity and peace that I have most days. And, you know, I'm really not very – I have a lot of other things I can be excited about besides being in all this crisis I used to be in.
Get that. Well,
so
thank you so much.
Spell the website so that I can – that website.
You want me to say it again?
Yes. Help me spell it.
Okay, it's cloud, C-L-O-U-D, hyphen, Ranishek. It's R-A-I-N-O-S, like Sam, S-E-K.com.
Great.
And we do have a place on the website where it says, and they can immediately respond, and then the email comes back to me, and I'll be happy to, get the report and talk to them, or have one of my my partner or associate or somebody talk to them.
So I've got the website in front of me now, and on the left it says leadership development, strategic planning, inclusion and diversity, customer service, overcoming ineffective behaviors, and meditation.
And it should, on the website itself, on the right-hand side, should be a place where you can tap and connect, can write an email and say you want to take the habitual patterns assessment. It should be on the right-hand side of the – I'm not looking at the website, but that's where it should be. It should also be close to where the radio shows are listed that we talked about, the habitual patterns assessment and what effect it has on people's lives and things like that. So it should be right there. Now, the truth of it is I certainly can give you my email address or whatever else. When we get off the phone and, you know, people contact you, we have to do the wave. But it should be on the website real clearly.
That would be great. Let's –
Well, we need to close.
I'd like to write down the email address. Yeah, we've got like a minute and a half, Joseph.
Yeah.
Okay, do you want me to get it now?
Yeah, please.
Okay,
is that okay?
Jacqueline. Yeah. It's Jacqueline, J-A-C-K-A-L-Y-N. Let me tell you what. Let me do it this way. It's let's put it at C-R-A, like Cloud Ranishek Associates, C-R-A at cloud-ranishek.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jacqueline. It's been really a pleasure. We got to scoot off. Thank you, Harold. Thank you, Jacqueline. It's been great, interesting show. If you need sponsorship information, remember where to go. If you're looking for it, we got it. It's rumradio.org. And remember, like usual, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.